In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
It's Robot Chicken Week on the Adult Swim Podcast. Today we're in Stupid Buddy Studios talking to Tom Shepard. He's been the director of Robot Chicken for a couple of years now. Let's see what he has to say. Where are you from?
I'm from the wilds of Southern California.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. Grew up in the Pasadena area.
Uh-huh. You haven't gotten far.
I haven't, really, yeah. in every aspect.
I've looked at your IMDb page. You got a million credits.
It's not quite at a million yet, but it's...
Pinky and the Brain, Jimmy Neutron, Scooby-Doo, Annoying Orange, and Mike Nichols comes up.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well, so... when I was 18 years old, I had worked for a producer named Neil Maclis as a PA for, I don't know, a couple of months. And I was a freshman in film school at USC. And they needed an assistant for Mike Nichols. And they asked me if I knew who Mike Nichols was, and I said, no. And they said, perfect. You're already on
is
your
that
way.
True?
It's absolutely true. And they said, well, have you heard of The Graduate? And I was like, yeah, oh, I love that movie. And they said, well, he directed that. And I was like, oh, cool. And they're like, well, that's the attitude we need. Mike doesn't like assistants who fawn all over him. He, you know, and you seem to have kind of an annoying attitude. We think you'd be a good fit. And it was insane. It was really a defining experience for me. I didn't think so at the time. I just thought, hey, here's a job, you know, that I can do and get a little bit of money for to help pay for school. And
everybody else knew that this was a great job for you, but you.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of defined my entire career. Like I've kind of been fortunate to stumble into these things that I'm not quite aware while I'm doing them of the significance of it. But the Nichols thing was fantastic. I mean, I hit it off with him right away. He was just lovely to work for. He did make me cry once.
What did he do? Or what did you do?
He didn't know that he made me cry. There was an incident where the Teamsters, and I love Teamsters. This isn't a Teamster slam. One of the drivers had moved his Winnebago overnight. We were on the Paramount lot, and they had to move it to another, you know, alleyway or somewhere, and they hadn't locked off the toilet in the Winnebago. So apparently, whatever was in the toilet sloshed up and got all over the carpet. Eventually, I found my way to the head of transportation, and I said, "What do we do? Mike's trailer smells like shit." And they said, "Oh, we know about that. We're working on it." And I was like, "Well, what happened?" They're like, "Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it." So the day goes on, and Mike shows up, and he comes in, and he takes a whiff, and he's like, "What is going on?" He's like, "I don't know. The transportation's on it. Don't worry about it." All day, people coming in and like smelling it and then scrubbing the floor and then leaving and going, oh, it's cool now. And I'd walk back in, still smelled like shit. Mike would come back from the stages. He'd come in. He'd go, ah, this is terrible. And he'd leave. And so this went on probably like 6-7 hours. And then midway through the day, probably 4 o'clock, he comes back in and I can tell the smell is pretty bad and he's really frustrated with it. And I said, Mike, what do you want me to do? And he not very graciously said, I want a goddamn new trailer. Might have said it in a tone you would not expect from him. And he walked out. And I've told this story enough times now that I don't feel embarrassed by it, but I closed the door to his trailer. I was alone in the trailer, and I just started sobbing. I was 18. I was just guttural sobs, and I was like, oh, I don't need this. I don't need this. I'm going to quit. And then I got myself together, and I walked out of the trailer, and I stood there, and he came back from the stages, and as graciously as he ever did, he gave me a hug, and he said, I'm so sorry. That was completely uncalled for. I know it's not your fault. I think it was a good lesson, you know, in something.
What project was it?
It was Regarding Henry.
Oh, Regarding Henry. Okay.
And it's also the place where I first really encountered someone who was a massive movie star who wanted to be treated like a normal human being and treated everyone beautifully, and that was Harrison Ford. The first day on set, I was so nervous. I was standing off in the wings, and they were doing some, you know, very intense hospital scene, and I think Harrison Ford was like, he'd been shot in the head, and he was drooling out of the side of his mouth, and you know, they called for a break, and I'm standing there with guarding the cigarettes and trying to be unobtrusive. And I look up, and Harrison Ford is standing right in front of me, and he puts out his hand and he says, "Hey, I hear you're working for Mike." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "My name's Harrison," and shook my hand. Didn't expect that I knew who he was.
Wow, completely unpretentious.
Completely. And the rest of the shoot, he was the same way. He wouldn't let anybody drive him in a golf cart. He had a bicycle that he'd take around the lot. Just the loveliest man.
So you're 18, coming out of film school.
I was in film school.
Seeing all this firsthand.
Yeah, it was pretty intense.
Why did you go to film school?
Well, I wanted to be an actor, I don't think my parents were real excited about that. I was, you know, like a drama geek in high school. And as a young teenager, I took it upon myself to get an agent. And that upset my parents quite a bit. And I, you know, I saw a little bit of the industry from that side on the occasions that I would get an audition. And then I got my SAG card when I was 15, I think.
What were you cast in?
It was a movie called Zombie High. It was a interesting, weird teen zombie movie about a prep school that is where the teachers are turning the students into zombies. I think they're extracting a serum from their brains so that they can stay young or stay alive. But the most interesting thing about it was the cast, because Paul Feig was in the cast from Freaks and Geeks and everything else. Sherilyn Fenn from Twin Peaks and Robot Chicken now. Virginia Madsen. I think.
Wow, an all-star cast.
Yeah. And then
I played
like a random student. I think I had two lines, one of which made it into the film. And
is it available? Is it on YouTube?
It is.
Can we link to it?
It is available. I can find the scene that I'm in. Yeah.
That's fun.
So then I guess I sort of felt, you know, as I was seeing all this, I probably came to this myself. My friends and I used to make films, you know, kind of the classic, you know, we had Super 8 cameras and we'd make little short films. And as I was looking towards college, I thought, well, probably part of it was the pressure for my parents to have the fallback career. And for some reason, I thought filmmaking was a fallback career to being
not
an
law
actor.
School or...
So I applied to a bunch of schools with film programs, and I got into USC. And it seemed like a no-brainer to me that I should go.
What do you tell people that you do now?
In terms of career?
In terms of Robot Chicken.
Well,
or in terms of career.
Well,
I don't know.
I direct Robot Chicken. I also write it, but I mainly direct it.
Explain what that means to direct Robot Chicken to the person who knows nothing about animation.
If you look at it from the perspective of any film project or any television project. It entails everything that you would think goes into that, directing actors in terms of animated projects, taking what's on the page, getting it into a storyboard form, which we then turn into what we call an animatic, which is the voices that I also direct with Seth and Matt. We marry that into a storyboard, into an animatic, which gives us the timing of the episode. And then we use that as the roadmap when we're on the sound stages directing the animators to give us the performances from the puppets on Robot Chicken.
What is the value then in stop motion?
I don't know. I've worked in many forms of animation and they all seem equally hard. I think the scariest thing about stop motion is that you don't get to traditionally on a 2D show or a CG show, at least here in Los Angeles, you basically prep the entire show and then you ship it off to an overseas studio to do the actual animation. And so it kind of gets out of your hair for a while and then it comes back and you have to call for retakes and things like that. But here it's just all very hands-on from beginning to end. So I guess that's the scariest thing about it, but it's also, to me, the coolest thing about it.
In other words, you can't redo stuff as easily.
No.
You have to know well in advance what you're doing.
And we try to never redo stuff on the show just because it's so labor-intensive to produce just a single shot that we'll rarely ask an animator to redo a shot.
Two very specific types of directing, directing the animation and then directing the voice acting.
Right.
Are those two sides of the brain?
I think they all go hand in hand. You know, they're pretty similar. Yeah. Yeah, I guess. I mean, the one thing I always say to the animators that I think they're sick of hearing is none of the characters that they're animating know that they're in a comedy. Every single character on Robot Chicken is living a drama. And it's funny to us. The writing's funny. What they're saying is funny. What they're experiencing is absurd. But they're not mugging to camera. They're not doing big, dumb, stupid walks.
Play it straight.
They're playing it straight. And for the most part, I'm sure someone's going to say, what about this sketch? I'm sure there are times when we go off the rails a little bit and do wink at the camera. But for the most part, the majority of the show, at least since I've been directing it, we always play it straight.
Walk us through your arrival here. So let's say between cleaning out Mike Nichols' shit trailer to here. Link that up.
Okay, well, I had been writing with various partners while I was in school. A friend and I had written a raunchy, I was a teenage Frankenstein live-action comedy called Frankendude. And we got lots of meetings. Lots of people would read it. This was probably a time when people weren't really buying movies about Frankenstein teenagers with giant dicks. So that probably worked against us. But
there might have been one. All I needed was one.
Yeah. And then the script fell into the hands of a guy named Tom Ruger and a guy named Peter Hastings at Warner Brothers Animation. And we had an agent at the time, and he said, do you guys know Animaniacs? And I'm like, no, what's that? And so he told us a little bit. And he said, well, they have this show called Pinky and the Brain. They're looking for writers. Do you guys want to go in and meet with them? And we're like, sure. It's a job. Yeah, that sounds great. And somehow in that meeting, I think, we pitched, well, does Brain have a nemesis? And they're like, not really. And one of us said, well, what if his nemesis was a genetically altered hamster? And they went, that's it. And that's a great idea. Let's do that. And we had an assignment. basically. So
wow.
That script became the origin of Snowball. It was Brain's nemesis on the show, voiced by Roddy McDowall. So then I stayed there for 5 or 6 years, working on a lot of different things. Then there was a regime change, bounced out of there. I was at Cartoon Network for a while. We're going to show called My Gym Partner's a Monkey that Tim and Julie Cahill created. Great people, great, funny, fun show. Then I went to Nickelodeon and worked on Back at the Barnyard, which was based on a movie that Steve Odekirk made.
Right.
And while I was working there, I worked with a director named Todd Grimes, and we became friends and fans of each other's work. And then I got a call from him saying, hey, I'm going to be directing this show for Lucasfilm, and they're looking for writers. Can I give them your name? And I was like, yeah, what is it? He's like, I'm not allowed to say. So
Lucasfilm.
So I went. I got called in. I had a meeting with Seth and Matt. They were doing a show called Star Wars. I think it was called Star Wars Squishies at the time, but it was a Star Wars show. And I met with them once, I think for the head writer job, and then I never heard from them again. And then a year later, they called me in again and said they were looking for more writers. And by then, I think it was called Star Wars Detours. And would I be interested in flying up to Lucasfilm for 2 or 3 weeks and breaking stories with George Lucas? Stumbling my way into.
What was your response to
into
that?
These jobs? Like, yeah, he's okay. No, I think I crapped my pants. So that's where I met Seth and Matt
and George.
And I worked with them on Detours off and on for a couple of years. And then
how does that come to work with George? What does that mean? Does that mean you're sitting at a table with George bouncing around ideas?
Yeah.
Like, criticizing each other's ideas?
It was the most surreal thing. We would come in 9 a.m. up at Skywalker Ranch and we'd break stories in the morning. We'd pitch storylines for this show in the morning. And George would be there not just listening to pitches, but actively pitching with the group and taking notes from the group and getting shut down by the collective group. And school, mostly the coolest thing was just schooling us in the minutia of Star Wars. And,
wow.
All kinds of things that we had lent all this importance to, you know, he would just undercut with, no, that's, like, I remember saying something about, we were talking about the Gamorrean guards from Jabba's palace, and I said something like, hey, George, I always wondered, are the Ugnaughts, which from the Cloud City, the guys who rip apart the droids, the little tiny pig guys, is like, are they any relation to the Gamorrean guards? Because I always thought they were. And he goes, no, it's just bad makeup.
And you'd see him his pitch be shut down.
Oh, yeah. I remember one time he was enthusiastically pitching something and then the room was quiet. And he goes, oh, okay, I know how this works. I'm never going to bring this up again. And it was so great because it was just – it embodied – for all of us, I think we all just felt this, like, loving kinship and, you know, this man who we all revered and loved was just as insecure about pitching his ideas as any of the rest of us. And
wow.
it was kind of beautiful. Yeah.
A real humanity to it, after all.
So I did that. And then I had sold Annoying Orange, which I co-created with the guy who created the web series, Dane Bodenheimer, to Cartoon Network. And so I had to go do that. And I wasn't sure how involved I was going to be in that. And so I started freelancing writing on Robot Chicken. And then Annoying Orange consumed my life. And I sort of, I don't know, you hear all these stories about people who create shows and think that they can just create them and then get a check. And I felt like what Dane and I had created was spiraling out of control without either of us being there full time. So I just wedged myself into the show and said, I'm in charge now.
What would an example have been?
I'm the captain now. Well, I don't want to name a lot of names.
Yeah.
They were all really good people. It was just a very odd time and an odd project, because I think coming out of the world of YouTube, this sort of homegrown world of guys making videos out of their basements, which is basically what Dane had been doing for 3 or 4 years, thinking that they could just translate that to cable or network television in the same manner, you know, but using technicians and professionals from within the animation communities. It was a weird mashup initially, and we had some people on the side of the company financing the show who weren't quite in line. They had never produced a show like this before, and so there was a lot of fighting over resources and what I felt we actually needed to put into the show initially wasn't quite there. So it was a little bit of a fight to get them to come around to, hey, this is going on Cartoon Network. This needs a certain level of professionalism that, you know, no diss against what people are doing for $500 out of their basement. We can't make the show for that. We have to do this on a professional level, and we have to use SAG actors, and we've got to bring this up a notch. And to their credit, they stepped up, and we had a really solid run, and you know, I'm proud of that show. It was the first of its kind to make that leap from YouTube to regular cable television.
Yeah, a sign of things to come.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a great experience. We had a ton of fun making the show, and I think, you know, it sort of became infectious. We started out, you know, struggling a little bit to get guest stars on the show, and then something happened season two where the floodgates just suddenly opened. And I remember we got Dave Grohl to be on the show. It turned out his daughter was a massive fan, and he came in. He played himself in a live action thing, and then he came in and did voices. And then he said, I want to be a regular on the show. I'm like,
wow,
that's cool. And then we got Olivia Wilde. And I remember saying, why did you want to do this? And she said, I was talking to Dave Grohl. He said he had a great time.
That was that.
Then David Cross showed up. And then Rainn Wilson showed up. And then Danny Trejo showed up. And Eddie Izzard. And like, it was just this cavalcade of people. You know, I'm used to going out to actors for the shows I work on, and you know, 9 times out of 10, you get no, pass, or I'm busy.
Yeah.
You know, most of these shows pay scale,
right?
So, or all of them do.
Here's $900.
Yeah, for you know, an hour's work.
Yeah.
And you know, if someone has a connection, they'll sometimes say yes, but usually it's just like, no, pass.
Try me next year.
Yeah, but this felt like it was on the level of. Like Yo Gabba Gabba, like
right.
When people were just showing up to do that show, you know, we did a holiday special, and I just pie in the sky wrote in parts for Alice Cooper, Weird Al, I think Britney Spears, and Bret Michaels of Poison.
Wow,
and it was like a Muppet Show type holiday special where there are all these like too many guest stars there. They don't have time to get them all on the air. And lo and behold, literally every single person said yes, except Britney Spears. So we did a holiday special with Alice Cooper, Bret Michaels, and Weird Al.
Wow. That's wild.
So Annoying Orange went away through some behind the scenes unfortunate incidents that ended up with the 40-episode third season order turning into a zero episode.
Wow.
Third season order.
That's a tremendous loss.
Yeah.
Had you been banking on it?
No, but
had you bought yourself a helicopter?
No. No, I had made that mistake on when I was at Nickelodeon on Back at the Barnyard. Our executive on the show had told us, the writers, you guys are golden. I can't see this show not getting picked up for another season. And I was in the market for a new car, and I was up in Santa Barbara, and I stopped. I feel sound like such an asshole. I was stopped by the Porsche dealership, and they were having closeouts on the 2008 year-end models. And I, spur of the moment, I bought a Porsche Cayman. Way more money than I could afford, but I was like, I got this good job at Nickelodeon for a year. So I bought the car, which I still drive, by the way. I've had it for 11 years now, so it actually worked out. But I came back the next week. I think it was a week later, and the same executive came in. He's like, "Ah, I got some bad news for you guys. Network's not picking up the show."
A week later,
it was like a week later.
Holy shit!
But it was fine. It was fine.
That's rough.
I don't know what that question was that led to my.
Well, we're the 40-episode order that went away. Mm. And then
So I wasn't,
you're high and dry.
I wasn't banking on that. Uh-huh. And then that coincided with Zeb Wells leaving directing Robot Chicken to go work on his own show, Super Mansion. So they needed a director on Robot Chicken. And they asked if I was interested, and I was definitely interested.
Yeah, because by then the show had been up and going. For a while.
Yeah, I think it was in season 7 had just been finished.
Uh-huh.
So they were going into season 8. So I lobbied pretty hard to get the job.
Yeah. So what's your day like now? Is it a crazy long day? Is it 9 to 5? What's it like?
It depends which part of the season. When we start writing the show, the first couple of months, we write the show for 6 months. Mm-hmm. The first 2 months, I'm still in the writer's room writing and pitching sketches.
Yeah.
And then at that 2 month mark, I leave the writer's room to start prepping the scripts that we have and start getting ready for production, which will happen three or four months later. And then I'm still going in the writer's room every day, not to pitch anymore, but to read the scripts and to vote on sketches and talk about production concerns, maybe begging to stop writing so many sketches about that movie 300, because it's very difficult to produce sketches with thousands of puppets. Once we're in production, I'm usually here from about 8 a.m. till 7 every night. From 9 till 6, we're shooting.
So people might not understand those practicalities of something like 300 when you have a traditional 2D animation. It's just another drawing.
Yeah.
But in this, it's a whole new physical world that you've got to build.
Yes. Yes.
And you go in there and you see these scripts come in and you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you ruin people's dreams.
Well, no. I mean, just like my weird notion that this is a drama – I also try, because I'm coming at it from being a writer originally, I don't want to curtail anyone's vision in the writer's room. So I will generally initially say, in my opinion, write whatever you want. We'll figure out how to make it. When we get to final scripts, when we're doing the final punch-up phase on the scripts, I'll get in there and I'll point out very specific things that are difficult, or, you know, if there's a character that shows up, there's a deformed mutant giant with wings that shows up for literally one shot. We'll try to come up with another solution than spending thousands of dollars and man hours building one puppet that you're only going to see for 3 seconds.
Do you remember what some of the more expensive ideas have been?
Oddly, this season we did – and it, expensive in terms of can be a lot of things. It could be the number of sets. It could be the number of puppets, the number of very specific puppets. Or it could just be how long it takes to shoot a sketch.
Ambitious, and, maybe.
Yeah. And this season we did a – we did a sketch based on the old show Pete and Pete. And from the looks of it, it looks like it's nothing. It's a bunch of characters saying, "I'm Pete," over and over and over for about 2.5 minutes. But it is hundreds of characters. And it is, when we storyboarded it and finished it in the animatic, I think it was like close to 50 shots for one sketch, which is insane. We generally do... in one 11-minute episode of Robot Chicken, we average around 120 shots per episode.
120 shots. And explain what a shot is.
A shot is one camera setup. So, you know, a close-up of Harrison Ford reacting to seeing the Holy Grail. That's one shot. Then turning the camera around and looking at the Holy Grail. That's another
shot. So 120 shots per episode.
Some episodes have far more and some have a little bit less.
Yeah.
So... one sketch with 50 shots, but it also has sort of this very epic cinema quality to it. So the camera is not very stationary. It's moving all the time, which adds another layer of production difficulty to each shot, because we have to either manually move the camera within each shot, or we have to use motion control, which is basically a, for lack of a better term, a robotic camera move. And so this one sketch, I think it took us, we started shooting it, our entire production schedule this season was 6 months from beginning to end. We started shooting it, I think, 3 months into the schedule, and it was the last shot. The last shot of the season was from this sketch.
And how long is the sketch?
I think the sketch is around 2 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of times we'll put an animator on one sketch and they'll animate the entire sketch. And it's good for them. It gives them ownership of it. With this sketch, and it's a great sketch. I'm really happy with it. But the animators would be on it for about 3 shots, and they would start – you could see it. Their eyes were darting around, and they were starting to lose their minds. So I'd just cycle people in, and they'd all have to do their duty on the Pete and Pete sketch.
How has this show grown then for you? I guess physically it's just gotten more animators, more sets, and also I'd imagine the nature of the topics has grown up. Or maybe not grown up, but grown younger. I don't know.
I mean, that's the biggest one to me. I think production-wise, it's still kind of the same beast. We've gotten a little bit better year to year making the show. We're a little bit more efficient. I think the assets look better now. The sets and the puppets, all, you know, the quality increases incrementally every season. And if you put season one against season 10, it's like you're watching a show from an alien planet and something from today. But they're still just as charming and weird.
Do you have go-tos that you prefer?
Most of my go-tos don't usually work in the room. So
like what?
Well, like I try to write a lot of David Lynch sketches, and then I later found out most writers in the room have never seen a David Lynch movie.
Wow.
I had a sketch called Eraserhead Baby Grows Up, and it was exactly that. It was the baby from Eraserhead, and we see him grow up and go to college, and he's still swaddled in his little swaddling, and he has a family. And it got all the way through to script, and then we have this like horrific round when our scripts are always too long, and everybody gets a secret vote. At the end of the day, you send in your votes of what you want to cut to try to get the scripts down to the length they need to be. And suddenly my Eraserhead Baby grows Up sketch got the axe from every single person in the room except me.
Unanimous.
Yeah. And I I came in. I was like, what the fuck is wrong with you guys? You loved this. And somebody, I think it was Tom Root, said, well, I got to admit, I've never seen Eraserhead, but I thought that baby looked funny. I didn't understand the sketch.
Was there a moment like in the time that you've been here, like what happened with the Annoying Orange when the floodgates of celebrities opened up and people were actively seeking to be on the show?
It seems like it's that way on this show all the time.
Yeah.
And we'll still shoot for, you know, Tom Cruise and Harrison Ford and guys like that. And, you know, most of the time we can't even get past their agents. But occasionally, like, some of the people who come in are, you know, mind-blowing, and who come back, you know, are mind-blowing.
And you direct them.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself feeling strange to be directing some of these big names?
Not usually, but I think the cat's out of the bag on this one. So I think I'm allowed to say that we had David Lynch on the show this season.
Wow.
And Seth and I went to his house to direct him in his home studio. And I was so happy Seth was there, because I've never become so tongue-tied around anyone. I just love David Lynch so much, and I love his work, everything that he does, his photography, his music. And it was just – I've never freaked out about somebody like that.
So what was that like, you and Seth get in the car and drive over to his house?
We went over to his house.
During the day, at night?
Like, it was during the day.
Uh-huh.
We sat in the studio with his assistant and one of his producers and waited for him. And I assume he was meditating.
Was he not prompt?
he was a couple minutes – might have been a couple minutes late.
Yeah.
But came in and was just as gracious as could be, and just kept asking us what we wanted from him, and went into the booth, and we proceeded to ask David Lynch to read the lines. He was fantastic. He did it as many times as we needed him to.
Does he do a couple takes first and then ask for direction, or how did that go?
I think we just dove right in. Uh-huh. He did one, and then we'd adjust. It was pretty great.
And he was kind.
Incredibly kind. Yeah, just sweet and lovely and gracious and friendly and inquisitive. Yeah.
So we got the Pete and Pete sketch coming up. What are some things people should be looking forward to in this new season?
Oh, man. We've got some good bitch pudding coming back. Oh, what else? Oh, there's a great Venom sketch. The Tom Hardy Venom.
Yeah.
With Chris Pine as Tom Hardy and Venom. We've got, speaking of Chris Pine, we've got a great Captain Kirk sketch coming up, that may or may not feature him as Captain Kirk. What else? Some great musical stuff. There's Godzilla the musical. We've got, a lot of, what's that show about dystopia where the women are all enslaved to make babies?
Handmaids.
Handmaids. Yeah. We've got a lot of Handmaid's Tale sketches.
Do you find things rising to the zeitgeist each year?
Yeah, for sure.
Pushed out through your show?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we had so many Handmaid's Tale sketches early on in the season.
I guess your show is some sort of a reflection on current events.
Yeah.
In a weird way.
Yeah.
What do you watch? What do you watch or listen to? Turn us on to some stuff.
Well, let's see. What do I watch? People always find my taste in television odd. I like a lot of different things. I like Ghost Adventures.
Yeah.
With Zach Bagans. I've tried so hard to write Ghost Adventures sketches, and it's impossible to parody that show.
Huh.
I love The Boys. Boys was great.
Do you feel like whenever you're consuming content, whenever you're watching TV or what, do you always feel like you have to have a take? Do you feel in the back of your mind?
Not really. I mean, I don't watch as much television as some people do here.
Uh-huh.
I'm specifically referring to Matt Senreich because I don't know how he watches. He literally watches every show on television. I don't know how he does it.
He was telling me all his different platforms that he has.
Yeah.
Netflix, Hulu.
I always picture there's like a there's got to be a television on every inch of wall space in his house, and they're all tuned to different things. And he'll look over and he'll see something, and he'll look over to the left and see something else, and look up and see. But I don't know. I watch a lot of weird old stuff too. Like I just rewatched all of The Sopranos. There's a game show from the 70s that's on Amazon has it on their Buzzer TV, which is where I originally saw it. But it's called Tattletales.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know that
show. I remember Tattletales,
yeah,
sure.
It's Bert Convy.
Bert Convy.
And it's a panel of three celebrity couples all talking about basically their sex lives in veiled tones. And it's incredibly uncomfortable. And it's also a fascinating historical document because – you'll have these, you know, everybody's on there promoting something and everything, like there'll be William Shatner and whoever his wife was in 1974 and Phyllis Diller and her husband. And then you'll have like there was an actor named Scoey Mitchell and oh, I can't remember his wife's name. Really? And like watching this and going, I don't know who this person is. And then going and looking them up and finding out about their lives. And I don't know. It's just really fascinating to watch.
Tattletales sketch Robot Chicken?
No, I've tried.
Have you?
Haven't been able to crack one. It's really hard to crack the room on voting for something that they don't have even a vague idea about or that takes – as long as I just took to describe Tattletales to you, to describe.
It's Nietzsche. There's an 18-year-old out there who's thinking about going to film school. What would you advise them to do to follow your path, which sounds like a really fun path?
I mean, I don't know that
I'm looking back.
Yeah. I mean,
be lucky.
My go-to on this is in Steven Soderbergh's book, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, about the making of Sex, Lies, and Videotape and all the tribulations of getting that movie to the screen, there was a formula in there that I just latched on to. Maybe I just latched onto it because I wasn't as successful as I wanted to be. And I don't know. But and the formula is talent plus perseverance equals luck. And I always thought it was cute. And now I just think it's brilliant because it describes everybody I know in this business who's successful. It's, yes, you have to have some talent and you have to have way more drive than your friends who want to go into the banking sector or the legal sector or what. Maybe not more, but you have to have a massive amount of passion for this type of work. And then you have to meet the right people at the right time, you know? I mean, literally every signpost along my career has been because I met somebody through a fluke, but while pursuing what I've always been pursuing, and that was writing and directing. So, I guess it's, you know, just be prepared and don't be an asshole. That's my other piece of advice.
Don't be an asshole.
Be helpful, but yeah, don't be an asshole is not bad. I mean, this town is littered with people who you know had a burst of notoriety and then vanished. And usually, you poke around, and you hear the stories, and you know, it's not that they just weren't talented anymore. It's that you know nobody liked working with them.
Pain in the ass.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, be lucky, and don't be an asshole. That's my advice to the world.
Tom Shepard, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Visit adultswim.com/podcast for links to some of the things Tom and I were just talking about. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email, adultswimpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to Dave Bonowitz and Christina Loringer for editing and producing these podcasts. Thanks also to Maggie Cannon for arranging everything. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.